You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole translators of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of the Complete Collected Works, Volume 175 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, Human Life in a Cosmic Context, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is Lecture 4, given in Berlin on the 27th of February, 1917. I spoke to you last time about the three meetings which the human soul has with the regions of the spiritual world. I shall have a few more things to say on this subject, and this will give me the opportunity to answer a question asked by our friends at the end of the last public lecture in the Architectural Hall regarding the forces which lead to the fulfillment of karma and outward destiny from a previous incarnation. I have been told that this is very difficult to understand. I shall, therefore, return to this theme in the course of these lectures, but it will be better to do so only after we have spoken about something which will perhaps bring about a fuller understanding of this question. In order, however, that what was said about the three meetings in the spiritual world may be further clarified, I shall today insert, by way of an episode, something that seems to me to be particularly important to discuss with you just at this very time. When we consider the ideas that have been embraced by the souls of all people of all educational levels, as a result of the intellectual developments of recent centuries, we become clearly aware that these developments have given a powerful impetus toward shaping world evolution and man's place within it, solely in accordance with the ideas of natural science. To be sure, there are many people today who are of the opinion that their mental constitution and inner attitudes have not been formed by scientific ideas. Nevertheless, these people do not observe the deeper foundations of their mental attitudes. They do not know the extent to which scientific ideas have crept in a one-sided way into their minds, not only governing the way they think, but quite especially also their feelings. Anyone who reflects along the lines of the concepts generally available in ordinary educational centers, and whose mind is formed in accordance with these concepts, cannot possibly feel the right and true relationship between the moral world, the world of moral feelings, and the world of outward facts. When, in accordance with modern thinking, we reflect upon how the earth, and indeed the whole firmament of heaven, is supposed to have developed, and how it might come to an end, we are thinking along the lines of purely outward, sense-perceptible facts. Just think how deeply significant it is for people's souls that there is the so-called Kant-Laplace theory of the origin of the universe, even if they do not always form a clear picture of it, which states that the earth and the whole fabric of the heavens was formed in accordance with purely physical and also chemical earthly laws from a purely material cosmic mist, for it is envisaged in a purely material way, that it has been developing in accordance with these laws and will, so it is thought, come to an end which will be determined by these same laws. A state of being will eventually come about whereby this whole cosmic structure will mechanistically come to an end, in the same mechanistic way that it arose. It is true, as I have said before, there are many people who resist this modern tendency to think in this way, but this is not the point, for what really matters are not the ideas that we formulate, but the attitude of mind out of which they come. The notion to which I have just alluded is a purely materialistic one. It is the sort of idea regarding which Hermann Grimm says that a piece of carrion encircled by a hungry dog is a more appetizing sight than this picture of the world arising from the Kant-Laplace theory. Nevertheless, it arose and could become established. Indeed, it not only became established, but the great majority of people who come across it find it illuminating. There are only a few people who, like Hermann Grimm, ask how future generations of scholars will account for the emergence of this crazy idea in our time. How it was possible that such a barmy notion of the origin of the world could ever have seemed illuminating to so many. There are indeed few individuals who, out of a healthy soundness of mind, ask such a question, and those who do so are, at any rate in these circles, simply regarded as weird. But as I say, what really counts are not the ideas that are formulated, but the mental attitudes out of which they come. This is what really matters. These ideas derived from certain intellectual tendencies, and although they were promulgated by learned people and have been disseminated more widely in such a way today that most people still believe that the world did not originate solely through such mechanistic impulses, but that divine impulses must also have played a part, the fact is that it was possible for such ideas to be formulated. That is to say, there is a fundamental tendency in people's souls to formulate ideas of a materialistic nature. And this tendency exists not only in the few scholars and other individuals who believe in such ideas, but it exists on a wide scale in all manner of people. Nevertheless, most people today are still wary of plunging courageously into becoming followers of Haeckel and of conceiving of all spiritual realities purely in a material form. People do not have the courage. They think of spiritual matters as having a certain significance, but they do not think about them. If the idea that has been characterized is generally accepted, there is room for a more spiritual dimension, and especially for the moral element, only in a certain way. For just consider, if the world really did arise in the way envisaged by the Kant-Laplace theory, and if it were to come to an end through physical forces alone, and all human beings with their ideas, feelings, and will impulses were to perish with it, what, for example, would become of the whole moral dimension of the world if everything else is disregarded? Of what significance would it be that on the basis that the world as we know it had perished, we had once said that this is good, this is evil, this is right, and this is wrong? These would be nothing but ideas from a forgotten era, swept away as something which, if this theory were correct, could not live on, even as a dim memory. Then the situation would be that the world would perish through the same mechanistic causes, the same physical and possibly chemical causes, whence it arose. From these same forces, phenomena swell up like bubbles, which represent human beings. Within these human beings, moral concepts of right and wrong, good and evil, arise. Nevertheless, the whole world returns to the silence of the grave. The whole edifice of right and wrong, of good and evil, has been an illusion of human beings, and it is forgotten and vanishes without trace when the world has become a grave. The only thing that then remains as regards the moral order is that people feel that for as long as the whole episode lasts, from its initial state to its end, they need such concepts in order to live together. They have to develop moral concepts of this nature. But these moral concepts can never be rooted in a purely mechanistic world order. The forces of nature, such as heat and electricity, have their place in the context of the natural world, where they also make their presence felt. Whereas moral forces, which, if the mechanistic view were true, would exist only in people's minds, would have no involvement there. They would not be like heat, which expands bodies, or light which illuminates them and makes them visible by permeating the world of space. Indeed, these moral forces hover as a great illusion over the mechanistic world order and will vanish into oblivion when the world is transformed into a grave. People do not think these thoughts through sufficiently. Because of this, they do not resist the encroachment of a mechanistic view of the world, but instead they allow it to continue in existence, not so much out of benevolence, but out of indolence. And if they feel the need for a certain intellectual stimulation, they may say, quote, yes, our scientific knowledge does not demand that we think through the implications of such a mechanistic conception of the world, but our wish to believe demands something else from us. So we put our faith alongside our knowledge and believe in something other than a mechanistic natural world. In that, we have a certain inner soul need to believe in something. Close quote. That is a convenient way of dealing with the problem. There is no need to rebel against what Hermann Grimm, for example, feels to be a crazy idea of modern science. There is no need to stage a rebellion. But this attitude cannot be justified by someone who wants to think his thoughts through to their logical conclusion. If one were to ask why people live so blindly in this impossible intellectual position, and moreover put up with it, the answer is, however strange it may sound if one hears such a thought for the first time, that they have, in the course of recent centuries, more or less forgotten to conceive of the Christ mystery, which should be at the focal point of modern life, in its true sense. For the way that people should think about the Christ mystery in modern times is that it irradiates the whole of their thinking and feeling. It really is the case, and I shall have more to say about this in the near future, that the position that man has adopted toward the Christ mystery since the mystery of Golgotha represents a standard according to which his whole world of concepts and feelings can be measured. If he is unable to conceive of the Christ mystery as a true reality, he also cannot develop any ideas and concepts relating to the rest of world existence, which are imbued with reality, which really penetrate to the truth. This is what we need to be particularly clear about. If people really do think in the way that I have described, and this is how most people today think, more or less unconsciously, the world splits into a mechanistic, natural order, on the one hand, and on the other, a moral world order. Now, timid souls, who nonetheless often think themselves to be very courageous, make the Christ mystery into something that is only part of the moral world order. These are people who see nothing in the Christ mystery other than that, at a certain time, a great, perhaps even the greatest teacher of the earthly world, appeared, and that it is his teaching which is of the greatest importance. However, if one regards Christ merely as even the greatest teacher of mankind, this view is in a certain sense wholly compatible with this division of the world into a natural order and a moral order. For of course, even if the earth had been formed in the way envisaged by the mechanistic world conception, and were to be destroyed such that there would be nothing left of it, it would nevertheless be possible for a great teacher to appear who could indeed do much to make people more moral and to teach them. His teaching might be of a sublime nature, but this would not alter the fact that at the end of the day everything would perish, and that similarly the teachings of Christ would have faded into oblivion, with not even a trace in anyone's memory. The fact that one does not like to think this through does not affect the issue. If one declares one's absolute belief in a purely mechanistic world order, one really has to deal with thoughts such as these. Now everything depends on the realization that in the mystery of Golgotha, something was accomplished which has to do not with the moral order alone, but with the whole world order in its entirety. Something that belongs not solely to moral reality, which, according to the mechanistic world conception, cannot really exist, but to the full intensity of reality as a whole. We shall arrive at the clearest possible perception of what is involved here if we turn our thoughts once more to the three meetings that I mentioned last time, though in a different sense from the way that I explained them on that occasion. I told you that whenever a person sleeps, he encounters, in the state between going to sleep and waking up, beings of the spiritual world who are of a like nature to his spirit self, as we have grown accustomed to calling it. This means that when he wakes up, he emerges from sleep in such a way that he has encountered a spiritual being, and he carries the after effects of this meeting, even though the experience remains on an unconscious level, with him into outward physical life. Now, what takes place within us while we have this daily meeting also has a definite effect on our future. Someone who does not concern himself with spiritual science has little knowledge of what actually goes on in the depths of the soul when one is asleep. Dreams, which to the ordinary way of thinking could betray certain aspects of sleep processes, give some kind of an inkling of this, but in such a way that the truth cannot so easily become visible. When someone wakes up during a dream, or out of one, or else recalls his dreams, these dreams are mostly connected with ideas that he had already acquired in his life, with reminiscences. However, this is only the outer garment of what lives in dreams or in one's sleep life. When your dreams are clothed with ideas deriving from your life, these ideas are merely the outer garment, for in a dream what is actually taking place in the soul during sleep is manifested in a veiled form, and what is actually going on in the soul during sleep is related neither to the past nor even to the present, but it has a relationship to the future. In sleep, the forces are formed which in a human being can be compared with the germinal forces developing in the plant for a new plant. As the plant grows, the germinal forces for the coming year are already developing in the plant for the future offspring. These germinal forces culminate in the seed formation process. This is where they become visible. But as the plant burgeons forth in this way, the germinal forces for the next plant are already there. The germinal forces within man, whether they be for the next incarnation or even for the Jupiter period, are present in this same way, and they are primarily formed during sleep. The forces that are thereby developed are not directly associated with specific events, but are related more to the basic forces of the next incarnation, among other things, but quite especially to these forces of the forthcoming incarnation. Thus in sleep a person is working on the seeds of his next incarnation in a future-oriented way. Hence, when he is asleep, he is already in the future. As I do not want to leave a vague impression in your minds about this, I should say that for the next state of sleep, the next incarnation is like our knowledge of the next day. We know simply from experiences that when tomorrow comes, the sun will rise again, and also roughly what its course will be, although we do not know what the weather will be like, or what particular events will happen in our lives. So the soul is like a prophet in sleep, but a prophet who only looks upon things on a broad cosmic scale, and not upon the weather. Hence anyone who were to have the idea that the soul would be able to visualize the details of the forthcoming incarnation in sleep would be making the same mistake as someone who thinks that because he knows for certain that the sun will rise and set on the following Sunday, and because he knows certain other things, he would also be able to know what the weather will be like. However, this does not alter the fact that while we are asleep, we are concerned with our future. So, the forces that we encounter during our sleep, which are essentially of a similar nature to our spirit self, work on the forming of our future. Another further meeting, if I omit the second encounter, is the third meeting, which, as I indicated in the previous lecture, occurs once in the whole course of human life and around its midpoint. When a person is in his 30s, he meets with what can, as I have said, be called the Father Principle, whereas every night he encounters the Spirit Principle. This meeting with the Father Principle, which, as you know from what I have already said, also has to occur for those who die before the age of 30, if they live through their 30s, they encounter it in the course of life, whereas in the case of a premature death, it occurs sooner, has a very great significance, because as a result of this meeting, the person concerned is enabled to have so deep an impression of the experiences of his present life that they are able to exert an influence upon his next incarnation. So, the meeting with the Father Principle has to do with the earthly life of the next incarnation, whereas our encounter with the Spirit Principle radiates into our entire future life, and also into our life between death and a new birth. The fact is that the laws within which this meeting that we have once in our lives is interwoven are not earthly laws, but laws which within earth evolution have remained as they were during the moon evolution. These laws are on the physical side associated with our physical descent, essentially with everything signified by physical heredity. This physical heredity is only one side of the matter. As I have already amply indicated, it is underpinned by spiritual laws. Hence, everything that renders the meeting with the Father Principle a necessity points back to the past. It is the legacy of the past. It points back to the moon evolution, to previous incarnations, just as what takes place every time one goes to sleep points toward the future. Just as what takes place during sleep forms the seed for the future, the process that is enacted, whereby human beings are born as the descendants of their ancestors, and also carry from previous incarnations what has to be transmitted from these earlier lives, is a remnant from the past. Both of these aspects, that which relates to the future and that which relates to the past, are, as it were, wresting themselves free from the natural order. The farmer still goes to sleep at sunset and rises at dawn, but with the progressive advances in our so-called culture, the connection with the natural order is loosened. In cities, one even meets people, perhaps not so very often, who go to sleep in the morning and get up in the evening. Man is freeing himself from the limits of the natural order. This is an inherent part of his development of freedom. Thus, because he is preparing for a future which has not yet come, he has, in a certain sense, separated himself from nature. Similarly, by bringing the past, and in particular the lunar past, into the present, he is breaking his connection with the natural order. No one, for example, can point to any need arising from natural laws for John Smith to be born in, say, 1914. Such an event is not governed by necessity, as is the rising of the sun or other natural events. During the moon period, everything was ordered in a similar way to our birth on earth. Nevertheless, with respect to anything that has a direct significance for the present and is directly related to his earthly existence, man is fully part of the natural order. Whereas, with respect to the Father principle and the Spirit principle, he bears past and future within him. With regard to that meeting of which I said that it occurs in the course of the year and is, moreover, associated with an encounter with the Christ, he is firmly linked to the natural order. If he were not connected to the natural order in this way, the consequence would be that one person would celebrate Christmas in December, and another in March, and so on. And yet, in spite of the fact that the various nations differ in many respects as to how they celebrate the Christmas festival, an integral part of the festivities, which always have some bearing on the meeting to which I have been referring, falls during the last days of December. With respect to this meeting, which is fully part of the yearly cycle, man is wholly present, and therefore directly associated with the order of nature. Whereas, with regard to both past and future, he has separated himself from it, as has been the case for thousands of years. In ancient times, man was fully linked to the natural order, also as regards past and future. Thus, in the Germanic countries, for example, birth was in such times governed in accordance with the natural order, for birth, which was regulated by the mysteries, was only allowed to take place at a quite specific time of the year, and belonged to a particular season. In these ancient times, long predating the Christian era, conception and birth were regulated in Germanic lands by that of which only as faint echo has been preserved in mythical form through the worship of Hertha. The worship of Hertha in those days consisted in that when Hertha approached human beings in her chariot, this was the time for conception, and when she had withdrawn, it was no longer allowed. The result of this was that anyone who was not born within a particular season was considered to be dishonorable, because as regards his human existence, he was not in harmony with the natural order. This was in olden times just as much a part of the order of nature as going to sleep and waking up. People went to sleep when the sun set and woke at dawn. These things have shifted in their rhythms, but what cannot be shifted is the central question of adapting to the course of the year. Through this deed of adapting to the course of the year, something is preserved, and needs to be preserved, in the human soul. What, then, is the whole significance of man's earthly evolution? Its significance lies in that man adapts himself to the earth, that he embraces the conditions of earth evolution, and that he brings to the future of his evolution what the earth can give him. I do not mean merely in one incarnation, but throughout all his incarnations. This is the significance of earthly evolution, and it can be made a reality only if man has, in a certain sense, gradually learned on the earth to forget his connection with the cosmic and heavenly powers. This he has learned to do. We know that in olden times, human beings possessed an atavistic clairvoyance through which the heavenly powers exerted an influence upon them. Man still retained his connection with the heavenly powers, and the heavenly world was able, as it were, to reach down to his inner being. This had to change in order that he might develop his freedom. In order that he might become related to the earth, there was no longer to be any trace of the kingdom of heaven in what he beheld in his direct visionary perception. It was for this reason that at the time of his closest relationship to the earth, in the fifth epoch in which we are now living, the possibility arose whereby man became materialistic. Materialism is merely the most radical, most extreme expression of man's relationship to the earth. This would, however, mean that he would be completely subjected to the earth if nothing else were to have happened. He would have had to become related to the earth and gradually share in its destiny. he would have had to follow the same path as the earth itself, and become completely wedded to earthly evolution, if nothing else were to have intervened. He would have to have become segregated together with the earth from the entire cosmos, and unite his destiny wholly with that of the earth. However, this was not what was intended for mankind. Something other than this was planned. He was, on the one hand, to be fully united with the earth. But a message was to be imparted to him from the heavenly world of spirit, which would, in spite of the earthly affinity of his nature, raise him up above this relationship to the earth. The bringing down of this heavenly message came about through the mystery of Golgotha. Hence, on the one hand, the being who passed through the mystery of Golgotha had to take on a human nature, while on the other hand, bearing within himself the nature of a heavenly being. This means that we should not merely conceive of Christ Jesus in such a way that he develops within human evolution like anyone else, albeit on a higher level, but that he develops as one who possesses a heavenly nature, someone who does not merely propagate a teaching, but who brings to the earth that which comes from heaven. That is why it is so important to understand what the baptism by John in the Jordan actually represents, and that it is not a moral act. I am not saying that it is not a moral act, but that is not merely one, but a real deed. And that something took place then, which is as real as events in the natural world, as real as if I warm something through some source of heat, and this heat is transferred to what is being warmed. It was in this same way that the Christ being entered into the human being, Jesus of Nazareth, at the baptism enacted by John. This is, to be sure, a highly moral act, but also a real event in the natural world, just as natural phenomena are real. The important thing is that it is understood that one is dealing not only with something deriving from rationalistic human concepts, which always merely accord with mechanistic, physical, or chemical laws, but that it is an idea which is at the same time just as much an actual reality as are the laws of nature, or indeed the forces of nature themselves. Once this has been understood, other ideas will also become much more real than they are at present. Although we are not now going to enter into a discussion about alchemy, we want to observe what the old alchemists had in mind. Whether they were justified or not, we will leave aside for now, and it could perhaps be the subject for another discussion, which was that their ideas should not be mere abstract notions, but that something should actually result from them. Thus, when an alchemist burnt incense and had an idea or experienced it out loud, he was trying to imbue this idea with such a power that the smoke of the incense took on a certain form. He sought such ideas as have the power to take hold of the outward reality of nature, not merely to remain within the egotistic aspect of man's being, but to intervene in the natural world. Why? Because he still had the idea that something occurred at the mystery of Golgotha, which intervened in the course of natural events, and which is just as much a fact as a natural process is a fact of nature. In this respect, there is a significant difference which entered in during the second half of the Middle Ages and toward modern times, toward our fifth epoch, which followed the Greco-Roman Age. During the time of the Crusades, in the 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries, and even in the 16th century, there were some people, especially women, whose minds had such a mystical quality that the inner experience which their mysticism brought them was for them like a spiritual marriage, whether with Christ or with another being. Being ascetic nuns celebrated mystical marriages, many ascetic nuns celebrated mystical marriages, for example. I shall not enter today into the nature of these intimate mystic unions, but something took place within their inner being, which could only be expressed in words, which lived within the ideas, feelings, and also the words in which the feelings were clothed. Valentin Andrea wrote his Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, which was derived from certain specific ideas and spiritual scientific associations, as a contrast to this. The Chemical Wedding, as we would say today, Chemical Wedding, is also a human experience. However, when you read this Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, you will see that it is not only about an inner soul experience, but has to do with something that encompasses the whole of man's being, and is not merely expressed in words. Something that does not simply live in the world as an inner soul experience, but rather as a real occurrence, a natural event. Where a person accomplishes something that is like an event in the natural world. Thus Valentine Andrea's intention in his Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz is to present something that is more permeated with reality than the purely mystical marriage of, for example, Mechthild von Magdeburg, who was a mystic. Through the mystical marriage of the nuns, something was done merely for a person's subjective nature, whereas through the Chemical Wedding, the human individual gave himself to the world. Something was being accomplished through him for the whole world, through processes in nature. This is, moreover, to be thought of in a truly Christian sense. People who thought in a more real way, even if only in the one-sided sense of the old alchemists, wanted ideas through which they would be able to deal with reality in the right way, and really take hold of it. Ideas that actually have something to do with reality. The age of materialism has initially cast a veil over ideas of this nature, and whereas people today believe that they think with absolute precision about reality, they live far more in illusions than, for example, the old alchemists, whom they so much despise and who sought ideas through which reality can be mastered. What, after all, can people do with the ideas they formulate today? We are experiencing, especially in our time, that these ideas lead them to illusions, to the empty husks of ideas, to the idols that they chase after today, and which have nothing to do with reality. For reality is reached only by plunging down into it, and not by forming all manner of ideas about it. It is, after all, possible to distinguish between ideas that are imbued with reality and those that are unreal in the most ordinary everyday occurrences. Most people, however, cannot manage this. They are so completely satisfied with the mere shadows of ideas which are altogether lacking in reality. Imagine, for instance, that someone today gets up and makes a speech in which he says, quote, "A new age must come, and is already approaching, when a person will be measured only according to his own worth, when everyone will be valued for what he can do." Close quote. Anyone would say that that is something arising from the deepest understanding of our time. But for as long as the ideas remain mere husks, however fine the sentiments may be, they do not live in the real world. For it is of little significance that someone should advocate the principle that people should be given the jobs appropriate to their capacities if he is convinced, in hindsight, that his own nephew is the person best fitted for the task. What really matters is not the ideas and conceptions that one cherishes, but that one is able to participate with one's ideas in reality and get to know it. It is all very well and also a great delight to have principles and ideas, and it is often an even greater delight to express them. But what is needed is that we really enter into reality, understand it, and penetrate it. We are plunging ever more deeply into what has brought about the infinite sorrow of the time in which we are living, if we continue to worship the idols of the husks and shadows of ideas. If we do not learn to see that it is not of the slightest value to have and express beautiful ideas and fine concepts, if this is not connected with the will to plunge down into reality and get to know it. If we indeed immerse ourselves in reality, we find there not only material substance, but we also find the spirit. It is the worshipping of the idols of mere shadows and husks of ideas that leads us away from the spirit. Moreover, it is the great misfortune of our time that people are intoxicated with fine words. This is at the same time also unchristian, for the fundamental principle of Christianity is that Christ did not only impart teachings to Jesus of Nazareth, but entered fully into him. That is to say, he united himself with earthly reality in such a way that he entered fully into this earthly reality, and thereby became the living message from the cosmos. The book which, if it is read properly, is the best possible educational tool for reality, is the New Testament. However, it needs to be put little by little into our own language. The existing translations do not fully convey the original meaning. But if the real meaning is expressed in everyday language, the Gospels will then be the best means of evoking a thinking that is imbued with reality, since in their every line they lack the kind of thought forms that lead to shadowy ideas that are devoid of any real content. What is necessary today is to grasp things in their deeper reality. It might sound almost trivial to speak of being intoxicated with ideas, but this state is so widely prevalent today that it is not so much concepts and ideas, however fine they may sound, that are important, but that the person who utters them should be grounded in reality. People find this infinitely difficult to understand today. Virtually everything that appears in the public arena is judged purely on its content, on its conceptual content. If this were not so, one would never have considered documents which are totally devoid of ideas, such as, for example, the peace program of Professor, or should I say, President Wilson, which is a vacuous conglomeration of conceptual shadows, as having any bearing on reality. Anyone who has any sense of discernment for murky ideas could well know from this assembly of mere conceptual shadows that it could function at best as an absurdity, which might then represent a certain kind of reality. What is really needed today is to search for ideas and concepts that are imbued with reality. This presupposes, however, that people can be deeply related to reality, that they are sufficiently selfless to unite themselves with what lives and weaves in reality. And there is much to be observed in our present age that leads people completely away from this quest for reality, although these things are not noticed. Many lamentable things are going on now, as anyone with any awareness can see. For example, it is possible at present for people to be impressed simply through the way that words are put together by a number of speeches, which have even been printed, which, for someone who goes not by words but by realities, are absolutely appalling. Speeches are being given by a highly respected person of our time, who, in one of his first speeches, proposes the view that with respect to the one side of his nature, man belongs absolutely to the natural order, and theologians are not behaving as they should if they do not leave the natural order to the scientists. Then The speaker goes on to say that with respect to the natural order, man is purely a mechanism. But the functions of the soul also depend on this mechanism, and what he specifies these functions to be are essentially all the functions that the soul possesses. Theology is then left with the consolation that although everything has been ceded to science, we can nevertheless still give talks. But these talks are littered with empty phrases, and they are full of discontinuities. I shall return to this aspect in the coming lectures and look at it in greater detail. Such that if one studies a thought in conjunction with the previous thought, with which it is supposed to be associated, there is no real connection between them. Nevertheless, the whole talk sounds absolutely fine. In the preface to these lectures about, quote, the molding of life, close quote, it is stated that these lectures were given recently before thousands of people, and that many more thousands will, without doubt, feel the need to find comfort in these lectures at this serious time. These lectures were given by the famous theologian Hunzinger and appeared in the Quelle and Meyer series on title Science and Culture, and are highly dangerous material. Because although they read well and have something quite enchanting about them, one's thoughts become utterly confused. The ideas have no connection with one another. And once one has probed what lies beneath the fascinating words, the whole thing is revealed as being absolute nonsense. In a future lecture, I shall say more in detail about the confused nature of these thoughts. Nevertheless, these lectures have been praised very widely, and no one paused to examine the thought forms, but instead everyone dwelt only on the word shadows. It is indeed the case that what manifests itself outwardly is wholly a reflection of what man develops inwardly. If he develops concepts that are alien to reality, reality itself becomes confused, and then conditions arise such as we have now. It is no longer possible to judge things by what one encounters by way of outward conditions. Rather, must one form one's judgments by studying what has often been developing in human minds, not merely for years but decades and perhaps for considerably longer. It is there that the cause lies, and it is there that one needs to look. Everything depends on Christ being accepted not merely for his teachings, for it is essential that the mystery of Golgotha is perceived in its true reality, and that there is the clear awareness that something of a super-earthly nature was united with the earthly realm through the person of Jesus of Nazareth. For the awareness will then dawn that morality itself will not fade into oblivion when the earth and even the fabric of the heavens perish, just as a plant becomes dust, and that, just as in a plant there lies hidden the seed for a future plant, so in the present world does the seed for the next world lie concealed, and human beings are connected with this seed. However, this seed needs the connection with Christ, so that it does not, in the same way that the seed of a plant that has not been fertilized dies together with the plant, perish with the earth. That the moral world order in the present is the germinal force of a future order of nature is the most real idea that there can possibly be. Morality is not merely something that has been thought out, and if it is imbued with reality, it lives now as a seed for later outward realities. A world conception, such as that of the Kant-Laplace theory, of which Hermann Grimm said that the spectacle of a hungry dog prowling around a piece of carrion would be a more appetizing sight, is not an idea of this kind. The mechanistic view of the world can never arrive at this thought that morality in its essence has the power to become a phenomenon of nature, that it is the seed of a future natural order. And why not? because it is essentially an illusion. For if you were to imagine that the mystery of Golgotha had not taken place, the situation would be as the Kant-Laplace theory describes. You simply need to think away the mystery of Golgotha from the earth, and this theory would be correct. The earth had to reach a condition which would, if left to itself, inevitably lead to human existence ending in the desolation of the grave. Because at the critical moment the earth was fructified by Christ, because Christ, who represents the opposite power to that which leads to the grave, a power that is of a germinal quality, descended to bear man up into the spiritual world. This means that when the earth becomes a grave, when it fulfills its destiny in accordance with the Kant-Laplace theory, the seed that resides within it is not subject to destruction, but is carried over into the future. Thus the Christ-inspired moral world order presupposes what Goethe calls the, quote, higher nature in nature, close quote. And one can say that anyone who can conceive of the mystery of Golgotha as a reality in the right way is also able to think in a real way and form concepts and ideas that are imbued with reality. This, however, is necessary, and it is also what human beings must learn before all else. For people have wanted to incorporate into this fifth post-Atlantean age either ideas which intoxicate them or ideas which make them blind. Ideas of the intoxicating kind mostly derive from religious spheres. Those which cause blindness largely arise in the scientific domain. A conception which, while acknowledging the validity of the purely natural order, has only the moral element in view, such as that of Kant, who places these two worlds of knowledge and faith alongside one another, must result in intoxication. Ideas of this nature, which are developed on a moral foundation, are able to intoxicate. And because of the intoxication, one does not see that one has actually involuntarily succumbed to the stillness of the grave, where all trace of a moral order fades and vanishes away. Alternatively, ideas can make people blind, as do those of modern science and economics, and something that it is especially hard to come to terms with, the political ideas of our present age. These ideas make people blind if they are not formulated in connection with a world that is understood from a spiritual standpoint, but only from the shreds of the so-called real, that is, the outwardly sense-perceptible world. The result is that everyone only sees as far as the end of his nose, and blindly forms opinions about what he can see with his eyes and grasp with the concepts that he has acquired, without the benefit of having formed ideas, which, through being permeated by the spiritual dimension, by an understanding of spiritual realities, are indeed imbued with reality. It is important to reemphasize what is so absolutely necessary for our time. For an historical perspective is often limited now to mere conceptual shadows. A great deal is proclaimed today about what Fichte has said to the German people. However, one only understands what Fichte said if one surveys Fichte's entire life, a life that is so deeply rooted in reality. In my book titled The Riddle of Man, I have tried to portray Fichte's life in its entire development, showing how closely linked he was with reality from his childhood onward. It would be really good if statements such as these about ideas being imbued with realities were not only heard in a superficial way, but were received on a deeply intimate level, and I really mean deeply intimate. Only in this way will one acquire a free and open perception, an inner soul perception of what our age so urgently needs. Everyone needs such a free, open, inner perception of this. anyone who has not made a particular point of pondering the facts that have been touched upon here is far too little aware that in our time the ideas and words that we exchange are but shadows and empty husks, and that everything has a tendency to lead people in the direction of ideas and concepts that either intoxicate them or make them blind. Do not take anything that I have been saying today as the words of some sort of fanatic, but rather as expressing an actual reality. We all have to live with our times, at any rate we should. And when something is being spoken about, one ought not to regard it as implying that absolutely everything should be done away with. Nevertheless, some sort of balance needs to be established. It is quite natural that everyone is being confronted with impulses leading entirely toward materialism. There is nothing that we can do about this, for the drive toward materialism is connected with the deep needs of our time. All the same, a balance must be created. I have to say that everything is geared toward leading man firmly in the direction of materialism. This cannot be prevented. It is part of the nature of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. But there needs to be some kind of balance, a particularly powerful means of driving people toward materialism is something that has hardly been viewed from this angle at all, the cinematograph. For what one perceives in films is not reality as it is actually seen. Only an age that has so little idea of reality as ours, which worships reality as an idol in the materialistic sense, could believe that the cinematograph represents reality. A different age would consider whether people walk along the street as they do in films, whether, if one were to ask oneself what one has seen, the images that one sees really correspond to reality. Ask yourselves, very honestly, is what you have seen on the street closer to a picture painted by an artist, which does not move, or to the ghastly, flickering images of the cinematograph? If you are really honest, you will say to yourself, what the painter portrays in a state of rest has a much stronger resemblance to what you yourself see on the street. So when people are sitting in the cinema, what they see there comes to reside within them, not through their ordinary faculties of perception, but at a deeper material level than is normal for the process of perception. A person becomes etherically goggle-eyed. His eyes begin to look like those of a seal, only much bigger, when he watches lots of films. I mean etherically bigger. This has an effect not only on what lives in his conscious mind, but it has a materializing influence on his subconsciousness. Do not interpret this as a denunciation of the cinematograph. I should like to make it quite clear that it is perfectly natural that there should be cinematographs, and the art of cinematography or filmmaking will be developed to an ever-increasing degree. This will be the road leading to materialism. But a counterbalance needs to be sought. This can happen only if the addiction for the kind of reality that is being developed through films is connected with something else. Just as with this addiction, there develops a tendency to descend below perception by way of the senses, so must there develop an ascent above sensory perception, that is, into spiritual reality. Then it will do no harm to go to the cinema, and one can see such images as often as one wishes. But if no counterbalance is created, people will be led through such things to relate to the earth not in the way that is necessary, but to become more and more closely related to it, to the point where they are completely cut off from the spiritual world. The end of Lecture 4.